Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Origin of Life, What Everyone Needs to Know, by David W. Deamer, narrated by David DeVries. Publisher's note, this audiobook refers to figures and photos included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Introduction. I'll begin with a challenging question. Why should anyone want to know about the origin of life? The answers will vary from one person to the next, but the simplest answer is curiosity. Anyone reading this introduction is curious because they wonder how life could have begun on the Earth, but there is more to it than that. My friend Stuart Kaufman wrote a book titled At Home in the Universe. The title refers to a deep sense of satisfaction that comes when we begin to understand how our lives on Earth are connected to the rest of the universe. There are surprises and revelations as we discover those connections. For instance, living cells are mostly composed of just 6 elements. As you read further in the book, you discover that the hydrogen atoms in your body are 13.8 billion years old as the universe, and the rest of the atoms were synthesized in stars over 5 billion years ago. Life on Earth borrows those atoms from the universe for a brief time and then gives them back. Then there is a practical consideration. Curiosity-driven research can satisfy scientific curiosity, but the discoveries we make sometimes have valuable spin-offs. My own experience in this regard was an attempt to make a laboratory model of a primitive cell. I needed to find a way to get a molecule called adenosine triphosphate, ATP, through membranes so that enzymes encapsulated in lipid vesicles would have a source of energy to synthesize ribonucleic acid, RNA. Asking that question and finding an answer a few years later led to a method called nanopore sequencing of deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, and commercial instruments that incorporate the original idea are now being manufactured. The cycle of discovery and invention is now coming full circle back to basic research because nanopore devices are being developed that will search for life elsewhere in the solar system. Astrobiology helps us understand how life can begin. The first speculations about how life can begin on Earth were published in a Russian language book by Alexander Oparin in 1924, followed by J.B.S. Haldane's brief essay in 1929. Both concluded that life's origin can be understood in terms of chemistry, and this view has guided research ever since. However, a newly emerged discipline called astrobiology expanded our perspective beyond the Earth and its biosphere. Astrobiology builds on ever-increasing knowledge of how planets, stars, galaxies, and even the universe began. We now have a pretty good idea how the Earth became a habitable planet and why life is likely to be distributed throughout our galaxy with its 150 billion stars and planets, some of them surely habitable. There are many pieces to the puzzle of how life can begin, and many ways to put them together into a big picture. Some of the pieces are firmly established by the laws of chemistry and physics. Others are best guesses about what the Earth was like 4 billion years ago, based on reasonable extrapolations of what we know by observing today's Earth and other planets in the solar system. There are still major gaps in our knowledge, and this is where scientists can have radically different opinions about plausibility. For instance, which came first, metabolism or genes, proteins or nucleic acids? Most will agree that liquid water was necessary, but was it in a hydrothermal submarine setting in seawater or a freshwater site associated with emerging land masses? Let's first consider how scientists working on such problems try to find answers. What is the difference between an idea, a conjecture, a hypothesis, and a theory? Everyone has ideas, and there's an old saying that ideas are a dime a dozen. The reason ideas are so common is that people generally enjoy pondering questions and coming up with possible answers. A conjecture is a fancy name for a complicated idea that attempts to explain something specific. Even though a conjecture might sound reasonable, it probably does not have a solid foundation of facts. In his book Life on the Mississippi, Mark Twain wrote, "There is something fascinating about science. one get such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such a trifling investment of fact? Twain's insight strikes close to home when it comes to the origin of life. Few facts and lots of conjecture. On the other hand, Twain was a great writer, but he was not a scientist. During his lifetime, a few pioneering scientists were beginning to explore physics and chemistry using a tool called the scientific method. What is the scientific method? In high school, most of us learn about the scientific method, typically defined as a process involving five steps. 1. Make observations. 2. Perceive an interesting question. 3. Propose a hypothesis. 4. Test the hypothesis experimentally or by further observations. 5. On the basis of the positive or negative results, decide whether the hypothesis is correct or at least has explanatory power. If the explanation is significant, repeatable by others, and reaches a consensus, the hypothesis becomes a theory. This sounds like a reasonable way to understand the world we live in, but in real life, the process is quite a bit messier, at least for origins of life research. There is so much we don't understand that each researcher has only a vague idea of the big picture, and their ideas often contradict the ideas of other researchers. What we do know with certainty is that the origin of life occurred within the framework of the immutable laws of physics and chemistry, so the goal of science is to use those laws to fill in the vast gaps in our knowledge, and perhaps someday to understand how life can begin. Can life be defined? There is little agreement about a dictionary-style definition of life that can be stated in one sentence. The reason is that cells, the units of life, are not things, but instead are systems of molecular structures and processes, each of which is necessary for the function of the whole. However, it is possible to list the most general properties and then describe the individual structures and processes in such a way that, when taken together, they can only fit something that is alive. Maybe that's the best we can do. So here are some general properties followed by a list of 12 specific properties that define cellular life on Earth. General properties. Living cells are encapsulated systems of polymers that use nutrients and energy from the environment to carry out the following functions. Enzyme-catalyzed metabolism. Growth by catalyzed polymerization. Guidance of growth by genetic information. Reproduction of genetic information. Division into daughter cells. Mutation. Evolution. Specific properties. 1. A living cell consists of two basic kinds of polymers encapsulated by a membranous boundary. The polymers are composed of six elements, abbreviated CHNOPS, for carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur. 2. One kind of polymer includes proteins that can either be structural or able to function as enzyme catalysts. The other kind of polymer is called nucleic acid and contains genetic information in the sequence of its monomers. 3. The monomers of proteins are 20 different amino acids, and the monomers of nucleic acids comprise 8 different nucleotides, 4 of which compose DNA and the other 4 RNA. 4. Living cells require a source of nutrients from the external environment. 5. Living cells require a source of energy, such as light or the chemical energy in nutrients. The energy is used to drive metabolic reactions that change nutrients into the compounds used by life. 6. Polymerization does not occur spontaneously, but requires a source of energy. As a result of metabolism, the monomers of proteins and nucleic acids have chemical energy added to their structures, which allows enzymes to link them together into polymers. 7. Enzymes catalyze the synthesis of proteins and nucleic acids, and the process is guided by genetic information in the nucleic acid polymers. Proteins are synthesized by intracellular structures called ribosomes. 8. As a result of polymerization reactions, cells grow and duplicate the polymers containing genetic information. 9. The nucleic acid called DNA can be replicated in a process catalyzed by the enzymes. 10. At a certain point in the growth process, cells with duplicated genetic information divide and thereby reproduce. 11. Errors called mutations occur in the duplication process, so that individual cells in populations such as a bacterial culture have variations in their genomes. 12. Some of the variations provide a selective advantage, and those cells and their progeny survive, while those lacking the advantage are left behind. This process is called evolution. These are the properties of living cells, and it is obvious that they are components of an incredibly complex system. When we try to relate these properties to the origin of cellular life, it is helpful to consider them one at a time as a series of questions. Where did the membranes come from that were required to form the boundaries of the first cells? What energy source was used by the first cells? What organic compounds were available, and where did they come from? How did metabolism begin? How did life become homochiral? What were the first polymers related to life? How were those polymers synthesized before life began? How were polymers encapsulated within membranous boundaries? How did certain polymers become catalysts? How did other polymers begin to contain genetic information? How were those polymers able to grow and replicate? What were the first forms of nucleic acids? What were the first forms of proteins? How did base sequences in nucleic acids begin to guide amino acid sequences in proteins? How did cells begin to divide and reproduce? What were the first steps of evolution? These questions represent the edge of what we know about the origin of life and will be used to guide the nuggets of knowledge presented in this book. The nuggets have been discovered by a few researchers who are brave enough to venture beyond the edge of the known into the unknown. They lack maps, but are sustained by the knowledge that life did have a beginning and that even extremely unlikely processes become virtual certainties given 100 million years and the immense surface area of a habitable planet like the early Earth. Most people think of science in terms of answers that can be read about in textbooks. But working scientists know better. They know that even though answers are the valuable output of science, the excitement lies in the unanswered questions they spend their lives addressing. This book is organized in 3 sections that reflect both the answers and questions. The first section, How to Assemble a Habitable Planet, traces what we know about the history of the biogenic elements from their origin in stars to their delivery to the Earth and other habitable planets in our galaxy. The second section, From Not Alive to Almost Alive, describes how simple organic molecules became increasingly complex over time, eventually assembling into structures that are almost, but not quite, alive. The third section, What We Still Need to Discover, addresses the question still to be answered if we are to understand how molecular structures that are almost alive become alive. Although we will never know with certainty how life did begin, it does seem possible that we will understand how life can begin on any habitable planet, such as the early Earth. Section 1. How to Assemble a Habitable Planet. Hydrogen is a colorless, odorless gas that, when given enough time, changes into people. How much time? 13.7 billion years. A good way to present the information in this book is to pose a question, provide an answer, and then go on to ask and answer another question. How do we know? The first question is obvious. Can hydrogen really change into people? To answer that, we need to start with a simpler question. Where do the atoms of life come from? The elements of life on Earth are billions of years old. It's astonishing to realize that the carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen atoms in water and in proteins, nucleic acids, and cell membranes are billions of years old. In fact, the number of hydrogen atoms in a human body is roughly 70% of the total number of its atoms, and hydrogen atoms are 13.7 billion years old as the universe itself. Can this possibly be true? Keep in mind that science does not deal in certainty, but instead proposes explanations that best fit the evidence and then tests the explanations by further experiments and observations. For instance, 70 years ago, there were two alternative explanations of the origin of the universe. One was a steady-state theory promoted by Fred Hoyle that said the universe did not have a beginning. The second, proposed by George Gamow, was that the universe did have a beginning. The term Big Bang was coined by Hoyle to describe this idea of a beginning. Gamow's theory made two important predictions. The universe should be expanding, and there must be a rumbling radio frequency left over from the Big Bang, something like the echoing thunder that follows a lightning strike. How do we know? Observations by astronomers showed that the light from galaxies millions and even billions of light years away from Earth was shifted from blue toward red, from shorter to longer wavelengths, which was consistent with a universe that was expanding from a point in time 13.7 billion years ago. Radio astronomers also observed a constant static in the microwave frequency range that seemed to come from all directions. This was predicted by Gamow and is now called the cosmic background radiation. Hoyle's steady-state idea was abandoned, and the Big Bang theory has been accepted by consensus because it has more explanatory power. Plate 1 shows what the universe looks like today. Most of the visible matter in the universe has gathered into galaxies, like our Milky Way. The galaxies are not dispersed at random, but instead form the clusters that are visible in the image. What you see are billions of galaxies, each with billions of stars, all powered by energy released when the protons of hydrogen fuse to form helium. At the temperature of stars, a hydrogen atom cannot keep its electron, so only protons undergo fusion reactions. The clusters occur because hydrogen, like all matter, has gravity, and gravitational force can cause hydrogen to gather first into clouds of gas, then into slowly spinning disks, and finally collapse into a star at the center of the disk, often with planets circling around it. Gravity holds the stars together in galaxies, and gravity causes galaxies to form the clusters seen in the image, which are not imaginary. This is an actual map of galactic clusters based on observational results. The central white line from left to right is not an artifact. It is the Milky Way, our own galaxy, which is viewed edge-on so that it hides the galaxies behind it. The dark areas obscuring some of the starlight is interstellar dust that is ejected from dying stars and then gathers into vast clouds. Atoms heavier than hydrogen are synthesized in stars. If stars did nothing but fuse hydrogen into helium, the universe would be lifeless. However, nuclear chemistry occurring in stars includes a second fusion process in which the elements of life, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur, are synthesized along with the iron and silicon composing rocky planets like the Earth. When an ordinary star runs out of hydrogen fusion energy, it first expands into a red giant and then collapses and releases most of its remaining mass as microscopic particles called interstellar dust. These particles are composed of silicate minerals and iron mixed with water and organic compounds containing the biogenic elements, together with trace amounts of other elements in the periodic table. How do we know? As ever-increasing technological knowledge has allowed us to construct powerful telescopes, we can actually see elements being ejected from stars that collapse when they run out of gas and no longer have a source of fusion energy. These telescopes aren't necessarily the sort that have glass lenses and mirrors to collect visible light. Radio telescopes can see radio waves. Infrared telescopes can confirm the existence of organic molecules in space. And other telescopes can build up images from ultraviolet light and X-rays. There are even telescopes like the Hubble in orbit circling the Earth far above the atmosphere that distorts the light from distant stars and galaxies. The image shown in Plate 2 is the remains of a supernova as seen by an X-ray telescope. It is called Cassiopeia A, and the image has been color-coded to show which elements have been ejected from the collapsing star. The purple color is iron, yellow is sulfur, green is calcium, and red indicates silicon. All that's left of the star itself is the tiny dot in the center, called a neutron star. Iron, sulfur, and calcium are used by life processes. But what about carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen? Where do they come from? In the late 1940s, the British cosmologist Fred Hoyle had an idea. He could account for the synthesis of carbon in stars at sufficiently high temperatures if beryllium, with four protons in its nucleus, fused with an alpha particle composed of a helium nucleus. Oxygen and nitrogen can then be synthesized from the carbon by the carbon-nitrogen-oxygen CNO cycle, shown in Plate 3. In the star we call our Sun, characteristic wavelengths of the various elements can be seen in the spectrum of sunlight. With the exception of hydrogen and helium, the amounts of the elements present in the Sun are similar to the amounts in the surrounding planets, a clear indication that the entire solar system was formed within a vast molecular cloud of dust and gas. Six biogenic elements compose all forms of life. The biogenic elements are simply those that compose most of the mass of a living organism. Because a typical living cell is around 60 to 70% H2O, or water, the major fraction by weight is the oxygen in the water. Carbon is the next most abundant element because it is present in all biomolecules like proteins and nucleic acids, along with nitrogen. However, in terms of the number of atoms in a living cell, hydrogen is the most abundant and represents approximately 70% of the atoms. How do we know? Suppose we take 1 gram of living bacteria, such as those that cause milk to become sour, or apple cider to turn into vinegar. The bacteria are certainly alive, and the acids they produce, lactic acid and acetic acid, are the waste products of their metabolism. Next, we heat the bacteria to 600 degrees Celsius in a vacuum, a process called pyrolysis, which causes the organic molecules to break down into atomic elements and a few simple molecules like water. Pyrolysis turns the bacteria into black ash, and when the ash is analyzed, it turns out to be mostly composed of elemental carbon mixed with small amounts of chloride salts, of sodium, potassium, magnesium, and calcium, along with a little phosphate and sulfur. When we analyze the gas that is given off, it is mostly water, H2O, with smaller amounts of nitrogen gas and sulfur as hydrogen sulfide, or H2S. Finally, we weigh the black carbon and calculate the mass of material in the gases. The results, after a bit of arithmetic, can be illustrated either as the percent by mass or by numbers of atoms. Oxygen composes most of the mass of a living cell because it is in water, H2O. In terms of the number of atoms, hydrogen is 62% of the total mass, followed by oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen in proteins and nucleic acids. Figure 1.1. Although phosphorus and sulfur are essential for life, they compose just a tiny fraction of the elements. The thing to keep in mind is that all of the biogenic elements except hydrogen and a little helium were synthesized in stars by stellar nucleosynthesis. The hydrogen in the water, proteins, and nucleic acids of life is there only because it did not get caught up in star formation. This is why a major fraction of the elements of life is as old as the universe. Interstellar dust provided the atomic and molecular seeds of life for the solar system. The image shown in Plate 4 was taken by the Hubble telescope orbiting the Earth. It shows a beautiful spiral galaxy called NGC 1566, which is an abbreviation used in astronomy for New General Catalog, followed by a number. The galaxy contains billions of stars, and regions of new star formation in the arms can be recognized by their reddish glow. But something else is also visible, the dark bands that accumulate within the galaxy and hide the light of stars. We see similar bands in the Milky Way, our own galaxy. Those dark regions are called interstellar dust, composed of the ashes of stars that have gone through their lifetime and then exploded. The stardust contains the elements that were synthesized within the stars, such as iron particles and silicon in the form of silicate minerals. A thin film of water ice accumulates on the surface of the dust particles, and the ice contains simple molecules such as carbon dioxide, CO2, carbon monoxide, CO, ammonia, NH3, and methanol, CH3OH. How do we know? In 1932, Carl Jansky was working at Bell Telephone Laboratories and trying to figure out sources of noisy static that were causing problems for radio communication between countries. He noticed that the static grew louder once a day when his antenna was pointing at the center of the Milky Way. It was hard to believe, but stars were broadcasting radio waves. Over the next 50 years, the antennas and amplifiers were refined to the point where it became possible to detect not just the radio waves, but also modulation within the waves caused by organic molecules. Over 100 such compounds are now known, and quite a few are related to the origin of life. These are composed of the biogenic elements, including water, H2O, carbon dioxide, CO2, hydrogen cyanide, HCN, ammonia, NH3, formaldehyde, HCHO, formic acid, HCOOH, acetic acid, CH3COOH, and even an amino acid called glycine, CH2NH2COOH. Later research led to the conclusion that ultraviolet light causes simple molecules in the ice that coats interstellar dust particles to form more complex organic compounds. These were transported first to the solar system and then to the Earth late in the planet-forming process after it was cool enough for an ocean to form. Other essential compounds were synthesized at the Earth's surface by chemical reactions in the atmosphere, ocean, and volcanic landmasses. Molecular clouds are the birthplace of stars and planets. The image in Plate 5 shows molecular clouds in a star system called Rho Ophiuchi, about 460 light-years distant from Earth. A light-year is simply the distance that light travels in a year, equivalent to 5.9 trillion miles. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, is at least 170,000 light-years in diameter. To give a sense of how big this really is, the star nearest the Earth is called Alpha Centauri and is 4 light-years away, and molecular clouds range from 3 to 70 light-years in size. In comparison, our solar system is minuscule, just 4.2 light-hours from the Sun to Neptune. In a very real sense, molecular clouds are the ashes of long-dead stars that have gone through their lifetime and then exploded and ejected their elements into interstellar space. Some of the microscopic dust particles in the clouds are composed of silicate minerals, while others are metallic iron and nickel. The dust particles in this image glow blue because they are reflecting light from nearby stars, while others range from brown to black. Elsewhere in the cloud, ultraviolet light causes hydrogen gas to glow red, an emission something like the red glow of neon caused by electrons moving through the gas. Molecular clouds are an important component of our understanding of life on Earth because they are the birthplace of new stars and solar systems. How do we know? The answer is simple. The Hubble telescope is in orbit 353 miles above the Earth's atmosphere, and it has provided incredibly clear views of processes occurring in the molecular clouds of dust and gas scattered throughout our galaxy. With the Hubble telescope, we can look deep into nearby molecular clouds and see new stars forming everywhere, some surrounded by the dust that will form planets. The solar system assembled from a disk of dust and gas circling the sun. A new star rises, like a phoenix, from the ashes of dead stars that have been cremated by the final heat of 100 million degrees before collapsing and then exploding as a nova or supernova. Because new stars emerge in a molecular cloud, they usually appear in clusters such as the Pleiades constellation, visible in the night sky. Their radiation drives away the dust of the cloud, and after millions of years, only the cluster remains. The Sun was once a member of such a cluster, but over the 5 billion years since it became a star, its sister stars slowly moved away into interstellar space. The interstellar dust particles and gas gather into clouds from which new stars emerge and turn into rotating disks. Planets form as the dust in the disk undergoes gravitational accretion into kilometer-sized planetesimals, which then collide to form planets. The asteroids in orbit between Mars and Jupiter are planetesimals that did not get caught up in planet formation. How do we know? Plate 6 shows a dust particle and...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?